Time passed. More Londoners strolled past him with looks of indifference, curiosity, faint disapproval, thinking him drunk or sick. Mallory peered through his tears at the building across the street, at the neatly enamelled cast-iron sign on its corner. Half Moon Street. Half Moon Street, where Oliphant lived. Mallory felt in his pocket for his field book. It was still there, the familiar touch of its sturdy leather binding like a blessing to him. With trembling fingers he found Oliphant's card. Once he had reached the address at the far end of Half Moon Street, he was no longer weaving on his feet. The ugly giddiness in his skull had changed to a painful throbbing. Oliphant lived in a Georgian mansion, divided for modern renters. The ground floor had an elaborate iron railing and a curtained bay window commanding the peaceful vista of Green Park. It was altogether a pleasantly civilized place, entirely unsuitable for a man who was aching, stunned, and dripping blood. Mallory pounded fiercely with the elephant-headed knocker. A manservant opened the door. He looked Mallory up and down. "May I help you?" "Oh, my word!" he turned, raised his voice to a shout. "Mr. Oliphant!" Mallory tottered into the entrance hall, all elegant tile and waxed wainscoting. Oliphant appeared almost at once. In spite of the hour, he was formally dressed, with the smallest of bow ties and a chrysanthemum boutonniere. Oliphant seemed to grasp the situation with a single keen-eyed glance. "Bligh, go at once to the kitchen. Fetch brandy from cook, a basin of water, and some clean towels." Bligh, the manservant, vanished. Oliphant stepped to the open door, glanced warily up and down the street, then shut and locked the door securely. Taking Mallory's arm, he guided him into the parlour, where Mallory lowered himself wearily on a piano bench. "So you've been attacked," Oliphant said, "set upon from behind. A cowardly ambush, by the look of it." "How bad is it? I can't see."
"A blow from a blunt instrument. The skin is broken, and you have a considerable bruise. It's bled rather freely, but is clotting now."
"Is it serious?"
"I've seen worse."
Oliphant's tone was ironically cheerful.
"But it's quite spoilt, that handsome jacket of yours, I'm afraid."
"They stalked me all through Piccadilly," Mallory said. "I didn't see the second one until it was too late."
He sat up suddenly.
"Damn! My clock. A clock, a wedding gift. I left it in an alleyway by Shepherd Market. Those rascals would have stolen it."
Bligh reappeared, with towels and basin. He was shorter and older than his master, clean-shaven and thick-necked, with bulging brown eyes. His hairy wrists were thick as a collier's. He and Oliphant shared an air of easy respect, as though the man were a trusted family retainer. Oliphant dabbed a towel in the basin and stepped behind Mallory.
"Be quiet still, please."
"My clock," Mallory repeated.
Oliphant sighed.
"Bligh, do you think you could see to this gentleman's mislaid property? There's a degree of danger, of course."
"Yes, sir," Bligh said stolidly. "And the guests, sir?"
Oliphant seemed to think it over, dabbing wetly at the back of Mallory's skull.
"Why don't you take the guests with you, Bligh? I'm sure they'd enjoy the outing. Take them out the back way. Try not to create too much of a public spectacle."
"What shall I tell them, sir?"
"Tell them the truth, of course. Tell them that a friend of the household has been assaulted by foreign agents, but tell them they mustn't kill anyone. And if they don't find this clock of Dr. Mallory's, they mustn't think it a reflection on their abilities. Make a joke of it, if you must, but don't allow them to feel they've lost prestige."
"I understand, sir," Bligh said, and left. "Sorry to impose," Mallory muttered.
"Nonsense. It's what we're here for."
Oliphant offered Mallory two fingers of very good brandy in a crystal tumbler. With the brandy, the dry-throated shock oozed out of Mallory, leaving him in pain, but far less numb and harried.
"You were right, and I was wrong," he declared. "They were stalking me like an animal. They were no common ruffians. They meant me harm, I'm sure of it."
"Texians?"
"Londoners. A tall cove with side whiskers and a little fat one in a derby hat."
"Hirelings,"
Oliphant dabbled a towel in the basin.
"You could do with a stitch or two, I think. Shall I summon a doctor, or do you trust me to do it? I've done a bit of surgeon's work in rough country."
"So have I," Mallory said. "Pray go ahead if you think it necessary."
He had another gulp of Oliphant's brandy while the man fetched needle and thread. Then Mallory doffed his coat, clenched his jaw, and stared at the blue floral wallpaper while Oliphant deftly pierced the torn skin and sutured it.
"Not a bad job,"
Oliphant said, pleased.
Stay out of unwholesome effluvia, and you'll likely escape without a fever.
All London's an effluvium today. This beastly weather. I don't trust doctors, do you? They don't know what they're talking about.
Unlike diplomats or catastrophists, Oliphant's charming smile made it impossible for Mallory to take offence. Mallory picked his jacket from the piano bench. Bloodstains matted its collar.
Now what? Shall I go to the police?
That's your privilege, of course, Oliphant said, though I would trust to your patriotic discretion to leave certain matters unmentioned.
Certain matters such as Lady Ada Byron?
Oliphant frowned. To speculate wildly about the Prime Minister's daughter would, I'm afraid, be a very severe indiscretion.
I see. And what about my gun running for the Royal Society's Commission on Free Trade, then? I make the unfounded assumption that the Commission's scandals differ from Lady Ada's.
Well, said Oliphant, gratifying as it would be to me personally to see your Commission's blunders publicly exposed, I fear that entire business must remain sub rosa, in the interests of the British nation.
I see. What exactly is left to me to say to the police, then?
Oliphant smiled thinly. That you were struck on the head by an unnamed ruffian for unknown reasons.
This is ridiculous, Mallory snapped. Aren't you government mandarins good for anything? This isn't some game of parlour charades, you know. I identified that female fiend who helped hold Lady Ada captive. Her name is
Florence Bartlett, Oliphant said, and pray keep your voice down.
How did you—
Mallory stopped.
Your friend Mr. Wakefield, is it? I suppose he watched all my business at the Statistics Bureau and dashed off at once to tell you everything.
It's Wakefield's business, however tedious, to watch the business of his own blessed engines, Oliphant said calmly. I was expecting you to tell me, actually, now that you know that you were enticed by an authentic femme fatale. But you don't seem eager to share your information, sir.
Mallory grunted.
This is no matter for the common police, Oliphant said. I told you earlier that you should have special protection. Now I'm afraid I must insist.
Bloody hell, Mallory muttered.
I've the very man for this assignment, Inspector Ebenezer Fraser of the Bow Street Special Branch. The very special branch. So you mustn't say that too loudly. But you'll find Inspector Fraser, or Mr. Fraser, as he prefers to be called in public, to be most capable, most understanding, and very discreet. I know you'll be safe in Fraser's hands, and I cannot tell you what a relief that will be to me.
A door shut in the back of the house. There were footsteps, scrapings and clinkings, strange voices. Then Bligh reappeared.
"My clock!" Mallory cried. "Thank heaven!"
"We found it atop a wall with a bit of brick propping it up, rather hidden away," Bligh said, setting down the case. "Scarcely a scratch on it. I surmise the ruffians cached it there for later looting, sir."
Oliphant nodded with an arched eyebrow at Mallory.
"Fine work, Bligh."
"And then there was this, sir."
Bligh produced a trampled topper.
"Is that rascals?"
Mallory declared. The coughing gent's crushed hat had been liberally soaked in a puddle of stale piss, though no one saw fit to mention this unspeakable fact.
"Sorry to miss your own hat, sir," Bligh said. "Likely stolen by some street Arab."
Oliphant, with the faintest wince of involuntary distaste, examined the ruined topper, turning it over and inverting the lining.
"No maker's mark."
Mallory glanced at it.
"Engine made. From Moses and Son, I should say. About 2 years old."
"Well," Oliphant blinked, "I presume that evidence rules out any foreigner. A London veteran, surely. A user of cheap Macassar oil, but a man of enough cranial capacity to have a certain cunning. Put it in the rubbish, Bligh."
"Yes, sir."
Bligh left. Mallory patted the clock case with deep satisfaction.
"Your man Bligh has done me a great service. Do you think he would object to a gratuity?"
"Most decidedly," Oliphant said.
Mallory felt the gaff. He gritted his teeth.
"What about these guests of yours? Might I be permitted to thank them?"
Oliphant smiled with abandon.
"Why not?"
He led Mallory into the dining room. The mahogany legs had been detached from Oliphant's dining table, and the great polished surface now sat on its corners of carven gingerbread mere inches above the floor. Five Asian men sat about it, in cross-legged alien dignity. Five sober men in their stocking feet, wearing tailored evening suits from Savile Row. All the men sported tall silk toppers, tugged low over their clippered heads. Their hair was very short and very dark. And a woman was with them as well, kneeling at the table's foot. She had a look of mask-like composure and a silky black wealth of hair. She was wrapped in some voluminous native garb, bright with swallows and maple leaves.
"Dr. Edward Mallory, son Agoshokai Shimasu," Oliphant said.
The men rose with peculiar grace, rocking back a bit, sliding one foot beneath them, and coming up quite suddenly to a supple-legged stance as if they were ballet dancers.
"These gentlemen are in the service of His Imperial Majesty, the Mikado of Japan," Oliphant said. "This is Mr. Matsuki Koan, Mr. Mori Arinori, Mr. Fusukawa Yukichi, Mr. Kanaye Nagasawa, Mr. Hisanobu Samashima."
The men bowed from the hips, each in turn. Oliphant made no attempt to introduce the woman. She sat with expressionless rigidity, as if secretly resenting the gaze of an Englishman. Mallory thought it wise not to mention the matter or pay her much attention. Instead, he turned to Oliphant.
"Japanese, are they? You speak the lingo, do you?
A diplomatic smattering.
Would you please thank them for so gallantly fetching my cock, then?"
"I understand you, Dr. Marori," said one of the Japanese.
Mallory had immediately forgotten their impossible names, but thought that this one might be called Yukichi.
"It is honour to us to assist a British friend of Mr. Lawrence Oliphant, to whom our sovereign has expressed obligation."
Mr. Yukichi bowed again. Mallory was utterly at sea.
"Thank you for your courteous speech, sir. You're a very well-spoken gentleman, I must say. I'm not a diplomat myself, but I do thank you sincerely. Very kind of all of you."
The Japanese conferred among themselves.
"We hope you are not badly hurt by barbaric assault on your British person by foreigners," said Mr. Yukichi.
"No," Mallory said. "We did not see your enemy, nor any rude or violent person."
Mr. Yukichi's tone was mild, but his glinting eyes left Mallory little doubt as to what Yukichi and his friends would have done had they met such a ruffian. As a group, the five Japanese had a refined, scholarly air. Two were wearing rimless spectacles, and one had a ribboned monocle and dandyish yellow gloves, but they were all young and deft and sturdy, and their toppers were perched on their heads like Viking helmets. Oliphant's long legs buckled suddenly beneath him, and he sat at the head of the table with a smile. Mallory sat too, his kneecaps popping loudly. The Japanese followed Oliphant's lead, quickly tucking themselves into the same positions of arid dignity. The woman had not moved so much as an inch.
"Under the circumstances," Oliphant mused, "a dreadful hot day, a tiring foray after enemies of the realm, a small libation is in order."
He lifted a brass bell from the table and rang it.
"So let's get friendly, eh? Nani o nomi ni narimasu ka?"
The Japanese conferred, their eyes widening, with happy nods and sharp grunts of approval.
"Whiskey." "Whiskey, an excellent choice," said Oliphant.
Bly arrived momentarily with a trolley of liquor bottles.
"We're low on ice, sir."
"What's that, Bly?"
"Iceman wouldn't sell cook but a bit. Price has trebled since last week."
"Well, ice wouldn't fit into the doll's bottle anyway," said Oliphant lightly, just as if that remark made sense. "Now, Dr. Mallory, pay close heed. Mr. Matsuki Koan, who happens to hail from the very advanced province of Satsuma, was just demonstrating to us one of the marvels of Japanese craft. Who was the craftsman again, Mr. Matsuki?"
"She is made by sons of Hosokawa family," said Mr. Matsuki, bowing in place. "Our lord, Satsuma Daimyo, is patron."
"I believe Mr. Matsuki will do the honours, Bly," said Oliphant.
Bly handed Mr. Matsuki a whiskey bottle. Mr. Matsuki began to decant it into an elegant ceramic jug at the right hand of the Japanese woman. She made no response. Mallory began to wonder if she were ill or paralysed. Then Mr. Matsuki fitted the little jug into her right hand with a sharp wooden click. He rose and fetched a gilded crank handle. He stuck the device into the small of her back and began to twist it, his face expressionless. A high-pitched, coiling sound emerged from the woman's innards.
"She's a dummy," Mallory blurted.
"More a marionette, actually," Oliphant said. "The proper term is automaton, I believe."
Mallory drew a breath.
"I see. Like one of those Jacques Audreau's toys, or Vaucanson's famous duck, eh?"
He laughed. It was now obvious at a glance that the mask-like face, half shrouded by the elegant black hair, was in fact carved and painted wood.
"That blow must have addled my brains. Heaven, what a marvel!"
"Every hair in her wig put in by hand," Oliphant said.
She's a royal gift for Her Britannic Majesty, though I imagine the Prince Consort, and especially young Alfred, might take quite a fancy to her as well." The automaton began pouring drinks. There was a hinge within her robed elbow and a second in her wrist. She poured whiskey with a gentle slither of cables and a muted wooden clicking. "She moves much like an engine-guided Maudsley lathe," Mallory noted. "Is that where they got the plans?"
"No, she's entirely native," said Oliphant.
Mr. Matsuki was passing little ceramic cups of whiskey down the table.
"Not a bit of metal in her. All bamboo and braided horsehair and whalebone springs. The Japanese have known how to make such dolls for many years. Karakuri, they call them."
Mallory sipped his whiskey. Scotch, single malt. He was already a bit squiffed from Oliphant's brandy. Now the sight of the doll made him feel as if he had blundered into a Christmas pantomime.
"Does she walk?" he asked. "Play the flute, perhaps? Or any of that business?"
"No, she simply paws," said Oliphant. "With either hand, though."
Mallory felt the eyes of the Japanese fixed on him. It was clear that the doll was no particular marvel to them. They wanted to know what he, a Briton, thought of her. They wanted to know if he was impressed.
"She is very impressive," he blurted. "Especially so, given the primitive nature of Asia."
"Japan is the Briton of Asia," Oliphant said.
"We know she is not much," said Mr. Yukichi, his eyes glinting.
"No, she's a marvel, truly," Mallory insisted.
"Why, you could charge admission."
"We know she is not much, compared to your great British machines. It is as Mr. Oliphant says. We are your younger brothers in this world."
"We will learn," said another Japanese, speaking for the first time.
He was likely the one called Arinori.
"We have great obligation to Britain. Britain opened our ports with the Iron Fleet. You have awaked and learnt great lesson you have teached us. We have destroyed our shogun and his backward bakufu. Mikado will lead us now in great new progress age."
"We will be allies with you," said Mr. Yukichi nobly. "The Britain of Asia will bring civilization and enlightenment to all Asian peoples."
"That's very laudable of you," said Mallory. "It's a bit of a hard slog, though, civilization, building an empire. Takes several centuries, you know."
"We learn everything from you now," said Mr. Arinori.
His face was flushed. The whiskey and heat seemed to have kindled a fire in him.
"We build great schools and navies like you. In Choshu, we have an engine. We will buy more engines. We will build our own engines."
Mallory chuckled. The queer little foreigners seemed so young, so idealistic, intelligent, and above all sincere. He felt quite sorry for them.
"Well, it's a fine dream, young sir, and does you credit. But it's no simple matter. You see, we in Britain have devoted great effort to those engines. You might well call that the central aim of our nation. Our savants have worked on enginery for decades now. For you, in a few short years, to achieve what we have done,
we will make whatever sacrifices necessary,"
said Mr. Yukichi calmly.
"Well, there are other ways to improve the homeland of your race," Mallory said. "But what you propose is simply impossible."
"We will make whatever sacrifice is necessary."
Mallory glanced at Oliphant, who sat with a fixed smile watching the wind-up girl filling china cups. Perhaps the faint chill in the air was only Mallory's imagination, yet he felt he had blundered somehow. There was silence, broken only by the ticking automaton. Mallory got to his feet, his head pounding.
"I appreciate your kindness, Mr. Oliphant, and the help of your guests, of course, but I can't stay, you know. Very pleasant here, but press of business."
"You're quite sure?"
Oliphant asked cordially.
"Yes."
Oliphant lifted his voice.
"Bligh, send Cook's boy to fetch Dr. Mallory a cab."
Mallory's night passed in sodden fatigue. He woke from a confused dream in which he argued catastrophism with the coughing gent, to hear repeated knocking at his door.
"A moment!"
He flung his bare legs from bed, yawned groggily, and tenderly cradled the back of his skull. His bruise had bled a bit in the night, leaving a pinkish stain on the pillow slip, but the swelling was down and he did not feel feverish. Likely it was the therapeutic work of Oliphant's excellent liquor. Pulling a nightshirt over his perspiring nudity, he wrapped himself in a dressing gown and opened the door. The palace concierge, an Irishman named Kelly, stood in the hall with a pair of glum-faced chars. They were equipped with mops, galvanized buckets, black rubber funnels, and a pushcart crowded with stoppered jeroboams.
"What is the time, Kelly?"